Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, I'm Diane Stemple from Heritage Radio Network on the road at San Francisco's Fancy Food Show for Cutting the Curd. I'm sitting down with Jonathan Kaufman, author of the thought-provoking book, Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. Welcome to Cutting the Curd.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm delighted, especially to meet you in person. It's always fun to meet a new author for me in person. Mm. It's much friendlier. Anyway, so this is a far-reaching historical book.
Yeah, it was definitely a book that kind of threatened to, you know, kind of expand beyond my own ability to tell the story every time I turned around.
Yes, it seemed like my first question is, what first inspired you to investigate hippie food?
I think it was just simply realizing that it was that it had all the hallmarks of a cuisine in itself, and that it was created at some time, and that it seemed to be dying out in mm-hmm. restaurants mm-hmm. on the West Coast, and it made me think, well, you know, why don't I treat this like any other cuisine that I write about? Why don't I look at the etymology of it, basically?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Also, the question for me was, as somebody who grew up in a small town in Indiana, mm-hmm. and my parents were cooking this food, like, mm-hmm. how did they decide to eat?
How did they get there?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So those were the two main questions. How did the counterculture begin eating these foods? And then mm-hmm. how did my parents get access to them in small town Indiana?
Okay. Now, did you conceive of it as a book right away? Did you, pitch the book?
Yes. When I first started thinking about it, I pitched it as a newspaper feature to the alt weekly I was working for at Seattle Weekly, and they mm-hmm. were like, and the corporate head of editorial said, you know, I just don't think the food's that good. I don't know if I want to really read about that. And I said, okay, well, I shelved that idea for uh-huh. 5 years. And,
okay.
and then I thought about it as a book, because the more I began looking into it, the more I realized there were a lot of stories there, and it had a lot of different facets mm-hmm. for me to explore. Mm-hmm.
And maybe not just food-oriented, more history of counterculture.
Right.
And history of how everybody was enmeshed and involved and... Yeah,
yeah,
how it proceeded.
And also history of nutrition.
Right, right. So. How did the project change over time? When did you set out? How long ago did you start researching? And how did it change over time?
About 5 years ago, I started framing mm-hmm. the narrative, breaking it down into segments that are now chapters in the book that
okay.
I could research discreetly and write while having a full-time job.
Mm-hmm.
About 3 years ago, right before I started selling, pitching it to publishers, I had wanted to have it continue up to the present. Because
mm-hmm.
I wanted it to be, because it, you know, they did shape the food that we're eating today. And
mm-hmm.
really talk about those connections. And we realized I realized, you know,
the
my
book
agent
would
realized
be too long.
It would be too much, and that the really the last three decades weren't as interesting as the first.
Okay.
So that was the big change, and also I decided at that point that I really didn't need to be in the narrative other than in the introduction.
Okay. I noticed that your chapters are usually separate topics, and chronology overlaps between the chapters.
Yeah.
How did you make that decision from the start?
Yes. Partly because, well, it originally came about when I thought everything was going to lead up to the present. But,
right.
But it ended up, because there were so many things happening, it was a grassroots movement. And and I couldn't, there was no sort of cause, effect leads to, you know, creates its own cause that leads to effect. There was no way I could create a linear narrative around it. I could simply trace patterns of influence and hopefully through, you know, the personal stories, because I'm a journalist, you know.
Right.
That just seemed like the only way to cover a grassroots movement.
Right. Because for me, it was a little confusing when the same people pop up in another chapter. It's like, where did these people come from?
Mm-hmm.
Why are they back again?
Because
there was a lot of overlap.
There was a lot of overlap,
yeah. Now, just to let the listeners know, some of the chapters are brown rice and macrobiotic pioneers, brown bread, separate chapter, back to the landers and organic farming, and then there's also a tofu chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So he does separate things food-wise, even though the stories in the chapters are mostly about people, movements, complicated relationships, would you say?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Now, did anything surprise you in your research?
I think a lot of things surprised me. That was the delight of it, was that I would start looking into something and it would just take me on some direction that I had not been expecting at all.
Right, so you didn't know this stuff, all of it, ahead of time?
No.
Okay.
No.
Now, one crazy thing that hit me was how crazy the diets were.
Yeah.
And there were even deaths from being too strict in a macrobiotic sense.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and I'm surprised it survived that.
Well, the counterculture kids, you know, when I started looking into it, I thought, oh, crazy hippies, but they were the ones who had the most sense. I mean, they often adapted these very, very kooky, very almost, you know, irresponsible diets.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And because they,
like,
they
promoted
dove
by
into
madmen.
Them. Yeah.
You know, basically.
Really. I mean, a lot of the pre-counterculture health gurus were just a little off their rocker.
Right,
I mean,
right.
Prescient and crazy. And
right,
way.
At the same time. But they were also fighting what I call big commercial food, which was poisoning us.
Yeah.
So, yes, they were right to be against it.
Right. And I think that, and when the counterculture was looking for sources of information about nutrition, I think the fact that a lot of the people they were looking to the, you know, information, that they were regarded as kooks, that they were like disrespected by the establishment, was part of their appeal.
Mm-hmm.
It was because they distrusted what the messages they were getting from the government, from media, from you know, even academic nutritionists, and so anybody else who had an interesting story, they were going to investigate it.
Now, what in the writing or the researching was the most fun?
Talking to people.
Okay.
I mean, it was
and
a lot of
many of them
fun.
Are still alive.
Yeah.
And
I really, that was the other impetus for writing the book now, is that, you know, I wanted to make sure I caught everybody while they, you know, had great stories. And
some of the older folks
were a little harder, you know. I mean, they were beginning to lose memory, but everybody else is, you know, they're in their 60s and 70s, and they're at this point where they want to tell the stories.
Yes, I'm sure they're happy to.
So.
Yeah. What was the hardest part of writing the book?
Knitting it together, definitely. Knitting, that was hard. Fitting it in to a full-time job.
So you worked throughout. That was my next question.
Yeah.
Were you able to take any time off?
I was really grateful I got to take two months of leave from the paper.
Okay,
to do the
finish up?
Writing.
Okay, that's good. Did you visit all the places? Did you visit Vermont, Minneapolis, and L.A., or did you just do it on the phone?
Yeah, no, I really wanted to get a sense. And there are also so many local archives. And because so much of it is based on oral history, that I really wanted to talk to people in person and then I knew that the moment I met one person, then I'd get a recommendation to go meet another person, meet mm-hmm. another person, and see what they mm-hmm. had. So there was definitely a lot of online research because so many newspapers are digitized now. Mm-hmm. That was hugely helpful.
Right.
But that was just always background information.
Before you went.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, so where did you go? You went to Vermont?
Let's see. Going east to west, I went to Boston, Vermont, Ann Arbor, Minneapolis, rural Tennessee, outside Nashville, Austin, and then all up and down the West Coast.
Great visits.
Yeah. Oh, and I could have gone to Madison. I could have gone to the Ozarks. I wanted to go to Boulder. I mean, I could have done quite a tour.
For the next book. Now, I'm wondering, what is your educational background? What did you study? Is it history? Is it journalism? What did you do?
Neither. English. I was an English minor, comparative religious studies major.
Oh, okay.
And then I ended up cooking after college. Uh-huh. And then
as many do.
Yeah. And then sort of stumbled into journalism.
Okay.
About 20 years ago.
Okay. What did you eat growing up?
I ate a lot of these foods. I mean, there was a real uh-huh. nostalgic component. Uh-huh. But at the same time, my parents weren't doctrinaire. Uh-huh. I had friends whose parents were, and you know, I continued, like, outside Mennonite. I grew up in a Mennonite family, and uh-huh. liberal Mennonites really embraced the diet, you know, uh-huh. around 1975 to 1978. So uh-huh. everybody I knew was eating the same food.
Okay. And which was that? Was that brown rice?
A lot of lentils, okay. brown rice, whole wheat bread, definitely. Uh-huh. You know, cutting out the sugar, cutting out uh-huh. any dyes in cheeses or, you know, processed foods, no sugared mm-hmm. cereals, things like that.
And what do you eat now?
I eat very, very broadly, partly because I eat for my work, you know.
Ah, okay.
So I still do go out to eat a lot.
So you
a fair
eat
amount
meat?
For work. I eat meat. I
You're
eat everything.
Not vegan.
No, my partner is vegetarian,
oh, okay.
so we cook vegetarian at home.
Mm-hmm. And that's really doable. That's sort of a healthy mix, if you know, to do vegetarian at home and yeah. meat outside.
Yeah, and I mean, I definitely, since in the 5 years that I've been researching the book, I have definitely integrated more whole grains back into my diet.
Okay, okay. So it's influenced you in a healthy way.
It has.
Okay. It's time for our break. This is Diane Stemple of Cutting the Curd interviewing Jonathan Kaufman about his new book, Hippie Food, which chronicles the long history of how hippie food has changed our diet in America.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd. Diane Stemple interviewing Jonathan Kaufman about his newly published book, Hippie Food. When did it come out?
January 23rd.
Okay. So now, on to the topics discussed in the book. Can you speak about, first, the history and differences of the first health food restaurants in L.A., I think they're called Back to Nature Health Hut
mm-hmm.
and the Aware Inn.
Oh, those were in the 50s.
Okay.
And those were actually not the first at all. I mean, the first health food restaurants date back to like 1910s, 1920s when they had a raw food restaurant called the Eutrophian.
Mm.
And there was one, a corrective health cafe. LA has this very long history of alternative medicine and alternative diets.
Okay.
Which are particularly centered around raw food. And even, I think many of them would have been considered vegan at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But the 1950s, the two restaurants I wrote about in the book were significant because they ended up, the people who behind them ended up directly influencing the counterculture, you know, 15
food
years
movement.
Later.
Mm-hmm.
But they were sort of the, I call them the outlier, in some ways the alpha and the omega of mm-hmm. health food in
mm-hmm.
LA.
Mm-hmm.
One was the Ware Inn, mm-hmm. was very posh. They served sort of continental cuisine along with, you know, vegetarian pilafs
mm-hmm.
and raw sugar cheesecakes. And so they attempted to really replicate sort of what the other cuisine that was happening in LA restaurants, only with a healthier, lighter bent. And
mm-hmm.
they did try to buy organic vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Back to Nature Health Hut was just a madhouse. It only lasted for 2 years because
okay.
they really had no business sense whatsoever. But it was like, you know, alfalfa sprout sandwiches on whole wheat bread and like a soybean tomato casserole, but
mm-hmm.
they'd have these like live hula performances and
hula hoops or hula
grass
from
skirt.
Hawaii.
Yeah.
Okay. Now let's talk macrobiotics. What I recall is how strict and boring the food seemed, and I couldn't be a good hippie because the food was too boring. So what,
I don't think you're wrong.
and just to let our listeners know how severe it was, no red meat, no sugar, no alcohol, no dairy, no refined flour, no yeasted breads.
Often no fruit.
No tropical fruit. Okay.
Yeah.
So what were they eating?
They were mostly eating Japanese peasant food
mm-hmm.
as prepared by American 20-year-olds who didn't know anything about Japanese peasant food.
Oh, so it would taste even worse
exactly.
by the 20-year-olds here than the peasants in Japan.
I have had numerous former macrobiotics tell me that their teachers actually cooked beautiful food,
mm-hmm.
Particularly Aveline Cushy, who she and her husband Michio were kind of Boston Center for Macrobiotics.
Mm-hmm.
But it was it. They didn't. They mostly focused on whole grains,
mm-hmm.
and their only seasonings that they really allowed were tamari, which
mm-hmm.
they kind of brought that name to America.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of the tamari was brewed soy sauce as opposed to
mm-hmm.
Enzymatically produced soy sauce like kikkoman. Oh, not kikkoman. Sorry, La Choy.
Oh, okay.
And sesame oil and umeboshi vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty,
it.
That was pretty
mm-hmm.
it, yeah.
Now, miso?
Miso as well, sorry.
Oh, okay.
Miso as
okay.
well. Yeah.
So miso is not one of those.
No.
you know if it has a different name.
No. Yeah, no, miso. Yeah,
okay.
They were some of the first Americans to brew miso.
Okay.
So.
And miso soup, while good, is pretty mellow. I mean, taste-wise,
yes.
It's like...
Yeah, they didn't like garlic, they didn't like spices.
Wow.
I mean, was it,
wow.
You know,
no pepper?
No, not really.
Oh, wow.
Might be too yin or yang.
Right. Now, what is the yin and yang business of food?
So, traditional Chinese medicine and you know, many East Asian cultures, like, have divide foods up into their yin or yang
mm-hmm.
characteristics and try and balance them in the diet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
George Osawa...
Another big guy in the book.
He was the guy who
very big
Japanese guy.
Guy
who invented macrobiotics and brought it to the United
mm-hmm.
States.
Mm-hmm.
He was the one who he picked up that idea, but he grafted his own ideas of what yin and yang were onto foods,
mm-hmm.
and so they had nothing to do with traditional Chinese medicine.
Huh.
So he would, you know, practice that you would want to balance these foods, and that Americans were, he would say that Americans are far too yin,
mm-hmm.
That we need to yangize our diets
mm-hmm.
by eating brown rice primarily and avoiding
mm-hmm.
sugar especially and alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And meat.
Okay. So now let's talk about white bread and brown bread.
Mm-hmm.
I remember... white bread being boring, always.
Mm-hmm.
But But it was, we were lied to about it being healthy.
Yeah.
Totally lied to.
Yeah.
Like, Wonder Bread was supposed to grow bodies in 12 ways.
Uh-huh.
And it had nothing in it.
Right.
I used to yearn for Wonder Bread because my parents served us something healthier. You know, it was still white, but a little more.
Yeah. I missed when my parents gave up white bread as when I was a small child. Mm-hmm. I would miss the grilled cheese sandwiches.
Oh,
there was something about that crisp, light texture that I really liked.
Did they make the grilled cheese with the brown bread?
Yep.
Oh, okay, but it just wasn't the same.
It just
it was
wasn't,
too
to me. At
yeah,
that time,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, it just. But I do think brown bread didn't taste as good in the beginning.
Right.
Like, yeah. Why couldn't we make the healthier foods taste better?
I think because nobody had experience. You know, you didn't have a tradition of baking this food. Like, all of that knowledge of how to make whole wheat bread light and tasty had been lost in, you know, from the 30s to the 1960s when we were all sort of switching to...
Excitedly eating...
Exactly, industrialized food.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when you have a bunch of 20-year-olds who are trying to teach themselves how to cook from whatever resources they can find, they're not going to... And with all these new ingredients that they didn't even grow up with, they're not going to get great results at first.
Right. Now, what do you think the percentages are now in grocery stores, white bread, brown bread?
I don't know the exact percentages, but they're I did read several news reports that have said that now whole wheat bread outsells white bread in grocery stores.
Yay! All over?
All over the country.
Oh, good.
However, my guess is that some of what they call whole wheat bread is...
Might be phony.
Right.
It might be like Wonder Bread with brown in it.
Yeah.
Right, okay. So let me see. When do you think brown bread began to taste better?
I think the mid-70s was a period when I think over the course of the past, you know, the previous 5 to 7 years, they'd done a lot of experimenting. And there were all these collectively run bakeries that sprung up all over the country. A lot of them were basing the recipes on Edward S.B. Brown's Tassajara bread book. Mm-hmm. And that recipe is still delicious.
Oh, okay.
It's a foolproof method for making large batches of bread. It was easy to scale up. And so, enough older bakers told me that by the late 70s, they felt like their bread had gotten lighter and more flavorful.
Okay. Now, let's talk a little bit about organic farming. Organic farming really had counterculture values built in.
Yeah, and still does.
Yeah, yeah. And to not destroy the earth, so like to take care of your soil and to not poison people with pesticides, which also takes care of your soil.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the story. Tell us about the Natural Organic Farm Association in Vermont.
So the Natural Organic Farming Association, which is now called the Northeast Organic Farming Association.
Okay. It still exists.
It still exists. It has 11 chapters
all over the
northeastern states.
Mm-hmm.
So it was founded in 1971 by a guy named Samuel Kamen, who he had been an engineer who'd kind of dropped out a little bit. He was a little older than those of the kids. He's traveled around the country, ended up charming his way into a cabin in New Hampshire where he and his wife and his growing family were living. And he decided he was going to grow his own food. He grew up in Brooklyn. He had no idea how to grow his own food. So he started researching the library, and he found a couple of organic farming treatises, and it really fit with everything else that was coming out of the counterculture, the other ideals that he was absorbing. So he decided he was going to, not only was he going to try and grow his garden organically, but that he was going to teach everybody how to do it. He sort of had this hubris that he, like he could
he
say
he was going to start the movement.
Yeah. And he really did. In Vermont and New Hampshire, he drove around both states, pinning up flyers at feed stores and, you know, and markets, anybody that would let him post a flyer.
Mm-hmm.
And they had this meeting outside and, you know, on this farm. Oh, he also set up a training farm.
Right.
So he had all these, like, you know, 17 to 25 year olds who he just invited them to come and live, and he would teach them how to organically farm, even though he didn't know much more than they did.
Right,
and they lived in teepees on his on this farm in in Vermont, and
so it was really back to the land.
It really was back to the land. Yeah.
I was not kidding.
Yeah.
Well, he's now. Did you meet him? Is he alive?
I didn't get to meet him in person. I did talk to him on the phone.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, he's in his 80s.
Oh, wow. Now, it's one of the reasons it was centered in Vermont was that there was really cheap land.
Yeah.
And then there were new roads which helped connect everybody.
Yeah.
Which I did not know that about Vermont history. And then I think it said 10,000 rural communities were formed from 65 to 75. Is that in Vermont or the whole country?
So I don't remember the exact figures. Vermont in particular. Well, I was so interested in Vermont because there was a large migration that was happening. You can see it in demographic charts. You could see it in the census.
Like something like 11% population increase between 70s and 80s.
Yeah, but in Vermont it was particular because it was dying. The city, the state was sort of dying out because it was hard to farm there profitably. Kids were moving to the cities. And then you had this influx, because the land was cheap, of all of these young, these young folks from other parts of the Northeast mainly, who settled in there, and they changed
city folk.
They changed the politics of the state. The character of the state.
Yay!
It was pretty amazing.
Well, it's a nice small state, so you don't need that many people to change it.
Yeah. And they also, because they were so involved in they were all community oriented, you know, despite the fact they wanted to live rurally, they all wanted to be part of rural communities. So they got it was very easy for them to get involved in politics.
Now tell me about Robert Horiat. Did he invent the farmer's market?
He did not invent it, but he certainly claims responsibility for bringing it to Vermont. And he was part of, so the farmers markets had been dying out across the country. Most of the ones that were still existing were these, you know, like Reading Terminal, or in San Francisco we had Alamany Farmers Market where you had stalls and you had farmers from all around who weren't growing organically. They would just sort of sell, maybe even sell somebody else's produce. And his vision was to connect the organic farming movement to the public by creating farmers markets all over Vermont. And so he established like more than a dozen, NOFA, Northeastern, they established more than a dozen farmers markets within just a few years. And that was happening in Madison and I think somewhere in New Mexico. There were other places where that was happening, but nowhere with the concentration that it did in Vermont.
So cool. I mean, I am still involved with Vermont through Jasper Hill, and in Hardwick at least.
Yeah.
They're just creating a whole economy of cheese and vegetables and, you know, all sorts of good things still.
So I actually have a question for you. I was interviewing Peter Gold, who used to be part of the Packer Corners commune down by Brattleboro. And he said that he and his commune, he was the cheesemaker there, and that nobody was really doing artisanal farmstead cheese. And so he was like buying things, you know, he's buying like manuals and trying to manufacture all these different cheeses, and some of them worked and many of them didn't. But he said that Back to the Landers were really responsible for the artisanal cheese movement in Vermont.
Now, I don't know the answer to that, because my Jasper Hill came in the early 200s.
Oh, wow.
So that's way after.
Yeah.
And I think that's around when other people started. So I don't know my Vermont cheese history as well as I should. Though there is a cheese trail now in Vermont.
Oh, wow.
There's a map where you can go visiting or checking out various cheesemakers, because it's packed with cheesemakers. Anyway, so sorry, I don't know the answer. The interviewer doesn't know the answer.
Sorry, I sprung that on you. I just thought it was interesting, you know, that this DIY ethos that all the Back to the Landers had spread to cheese, too.
Now, more of what I was expecting in the book before I had opened it was, there's a quote, that says the back to the Landers had an unexamined nostalgia for the 19th century and the fantasy of self-sufficiency. And I guess I was expecting less facts and more philosophy. And it was interesting to see how packed your book is with facts. You know, just real history, real interviews. And then there's a bad guy, Frederick Stave.
Stare.
Harvard School of Public Health.
Yeah. He was the most vocal opponent of organics,
right.
Of health food. He put out several books. One was called, he co-authored a book called Panic in the Pantry.
Right.
And he would, you know, he used to say things like, you know, chemicals are our friends.
Yes, food additives are like friends.
Right.
What is he talking about? Did he believe it or was he paid off?
Well, both of those. he was, his opinion was that if you ate a balanced diet,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, we would get all the vitamins and nutrients we needed. And he really believed
that. Well, that might be true, but balanced how?
Right. But then there's also been some scholarship in the past few years, in fact, since I started writing the book,
mm-hmm.
That has looked at his funding from the sugar industry. And that he really did receive a fair amount of funding, and,
mm-hmm.
and you could sort of trace that in his anti-sugar stance. Or his,
right.
So.
Yeah. I've read other books about the fat crisis, where it just seems like the bad guys don't want us to know the real health benefits of fat,
mm-hmm.
Which of course cheese people are into.
Mm-hmm.
And instead want us to do low fat, which is awful.
Yeah.
You know, awful and crazy. Anyway, so now I want to talk about Grace Gershuny Jensen, mm-hmm. a New Yorker who moved to Vermont in 73 and apparently was super instrumental in developing organic certification.
Yeah, so by the early 1970s, there was some talk about organic certification from
mm-hmm.
the Rodale
mm-hmm.
Press, which put out Organic Farming and Gardening magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And so they came out to California and tried to come up with some idea of what certification was. But it really wasn't until the mid-70s when you had a critical mass of organic farmers who were also going to the farmers markets and seeing people kind of sell their produce as organic, whether
uh-huh,
they did or
when
not.
It wasn't, right.
And there were all these concerns around faking. And so Grace was in Vermont, Grace was really instrumental in figuring out what would it look like to certify an organic farmer?
Mm-hmm.
And then at that point, it was really organic matter in the soil rather than testing for all of these for chemical residue.
Okay.
But the certification framework was like one page long, you know, and it was voted on by the members of NOFA. She was part
mm-hmm.
of so it felt like a participatory peer review process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But Grace was also instrumental in the 1990s as the USDA finally got interested. As organics
mm-hmm.
became a big enough business,
mm-hmm.
and as there were enough scandals around pesticide residue
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that got people interested in organics in a way that they hadn't in the 1970s,
mm-hmm.
That she started translating, you know, these sort of older community generated
mm-hmm.
standards into
mm-hmm.
industry standards.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had then ended up, you know, fighting in many ways with all the people who had supported her in the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I know cheese people have a little bit of a different slant on organic, because organic for cheese doesn't necessarily mean good cheese.
Yeah.
You know, and I imagine there are different standards in different industries that it's more meaningful for some than others.
Yeah.
And now it is big business.
It really is. It's more than $43 billion business.
Yeah, yeah.
Industry.
So, you know, then when it gets that big, you just get curious, well, does it still mean something?
Yeah. Those are very good questions.
Okay. Now, oh, and I also see Cayman started Stonyfield Farm.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
Yeah.
That was that there's a real, you know, respectable yogurt still.
Yeah. Well, from him. I mean, he was never anti-big business. He what was sort of fascinating was that he moved around a little bit in that in 1970s, but then ended up on this plot of land that where it was too stony. The field was too stony to graze to raise vegetables, and so he started raising Jersey cows, and they made yogurt out of it, and
that's how it got called Stony Field.
Yep.
Very cool. I like that story. I didn't know that. Was that in the book? I missed it.
Maybe not. I don't know.
Okay. Now, vegetarian food. Why was it so bad then and so delicious now?
I agree with you 100%, by the way. I think, again, it was that problem of 20-year-olds, you know, who had never been raised
cooks.
On it, who had no idea, like, how to build flavors, and then they were adopting all of these ingredients, like, you know, whole grains that nobody knew how to cook with, and more things like miso and tamari and tahini. But the vegetarian diets before 1970 were pretty ascetic. Even the Seventh-day Adventists, who'd been vegetarian since the 1840s, they had a very, very simple diet, and it relied a lot on prepackaged meat substitutes, like nuttolene and protose.
That's always a mistake to me. Like, I went to Rich Table in San Francisco Friday night and had roasted cauliflower, and it was absolutely delicious.
Yeah.
I roast cauliflower, and I love to order roast cauliflower.
Oh, I love that cauliflower. It's great.
And I don't even remember cauliflower from my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Do you? Or maybe not very much.
We had a little bit of the milk cheese, you know, we would have cheesy cauliflower.
Oh, okay. Right. Okay.
I didn't like it.
Now, was it borrowing from other cultures that helped?
That was a big part of it, especially initially, is that...
Who were less meat-centric, perhaps.
Right. And a lot of people told me, they were like, well, if India can build a great cuisine out of, you know, vegetarian, well, why can't we just adopt all of these ingredients and techniques and learn from them?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So the same happened with anything, any dish they could make vegetarian that had more vibrant spicing or just came in different forms.
And Molly Katzen's Moosewood Cookbook helped considerably.
Yeah, for me, my Moosewood Cookbook is sort of the end of the story, but for most people, it's the beginning of the story.
Yes, that was what I noticed too. It's like, oh, here's something familiar.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, so just a few more tricky questions.
Uh-oh.
In San Francisco, what do you think was the relationship between the communal food culture and the development of San Francisco as the current tech hub? Do you see any connections?
There is a very, very good book. I'm going to blank on the title, but I think it's What the Dormouse Said, about the connection between psychedelic culture and the birth of the personal computing industry. And so you certainly, I did not even look into that, but I certainly, you know, Steve Jobs was somebody who followed some of the, you know, the pre-hippie health food diets.
Right,
he was a fruitarian for a while.
Mm-hmm.
There was this connection between creative modes of living and creative thinking and a certain distrust of the
companies,
establishment.
Yeah, and working in your garage instead of getting a job.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it's
and
sort of
countercultural.
Yeah,
there's a utopian aspect to the tech industry here as well, and I think that came out of the 60s.
Mm, okay. Now, this is a harder question, I think. You write almost an apology in the intro about how white the world of hippie food was.
Yeah.
And you even use the word disgust. Like, you're mad at yourself or the world, or, you know, can you talk about that a little? And how do we help that? Are there books? Are there recommendations? What do you think?
Well, I think the first thing would be that the world is changing very quickly, and the sustainable agriculture world, the world of sustainable food is going through a great necessary change right mm-hmm. now, where it's mm-hmm. where it's a lot of the movement is coming from people of color, mm-hmm. and so it's expanding the audience. And I think that the messages that are coming out today are much more inclusive, much more interesting, much more nuanced mm-hmm. than they were in the 1970s. But mm-hmm. I had, as somebody who's written about food in the Bay Area and Seattle for mm-hmm. 20 years, mm-hmm. I've just always written about, you know, I mean,
everybody.
Mm-hmm. That's who mm-hmm. my audience is. That's who's making food. Mm-hmm. And to then want to take that back to the 1970s and realize how white most of the circles
right.
were. And
right.
the circle, and this is the cuisine that shaped my ideas about
right.
food.
Right, right.
That was the part where it became a little bit more painful, you know?
Right.
Okay,
because I felt like you shouldn't blame yourself, or this is just what you chose and it's history. And you can't insert people that weren't there.
But also, I think to not address it, you know, I was really writing for three generations.
Right.
I was writing for the baby boomers who lived it, people mm-hmm. like me who mm-hmm. grew up eating it, whether they wanted mm-hmm. to or not, and mm-hmm. then you know, millennials.
Right.
And
right.
And I think all
so you felt you should explain yeah, why this was missing.
To not address it mm-hmm. would have looked too much like an oversight.
Okay. Because I thought, I read it and I started like, oh no, like, you're unhappy. Like, do I want to start the book?
Sure. Yeah, but I wanted to explain the flaws.
Pretty strict. You were pretty strict on the topic, you know, like just feeling bad, like this is, we're neglecting a whole bunch of people here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and those reflect my, you know, right. criticism of the sustainable food movement for the past 20 years too.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Well, you're right. Still in, you know, in being at the fancy food show, you can still see that it's mm-hmm. a very white place.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, well, I want to thank you. Thanks so much, Jonathan Kaufman. I encourage all to read his extremely interesting book, which presents a very in-depth history of hippie food.
That I hope is fun as well.
Yes, yes, yes. And,
it was a funny time.
There are a lot of great stories that we barely mentioned. You know, the characters abound mm-hmm. in the book. So thank you very much for being on Cutting the Curd.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.